Welcome and thank you for joining us for today's IBM Teleconference, IMS, and Modern Storage Subsystems, How to Improve Performance. Today's teleconference will be recorded, will last approximately 60 minutes, and will include a live question and answer session. In this teleconference, you'll learn how you can improve IMS performance by enabling multiple systems to concurrently access and update the same logical volume on the DS8000, using parallel access volumes to enable ZOS systems to make multiple concurrent accesses to a single volume from a single host, managing few large volumes instead of many small volumes using EAV, thereby removing some layers of complexity. The speakers for today's teleconference are Rich Lewis, IMS Advanced Technical Support Specialist, Frank Riccio, IMS Database Developer, and Bob Magid, IMS Tools Architect. At this time, I would like to hand it over to our first speaker, Rich Lewis.
Thank you. As the introduction said, we're going to be talking about IMS and modern storage subsystems. Page 2 of the slides lists the topics we're going to talk about. The intent is not to talk about any specific storage subsystem. Instead, what we want to do is talk about storage subsystems in general and how IMS interfaces with them and how IMS can take advantage of the capabilities of these storage subsystems. But to give you an example, you can look on page 3, which outlines the gives the highlights of the IBM DS8300, which is kind of the top-of-the-line storage subsystems from IBM that you might use with IMS. The first thing that might strike you about storage subsystems today is their capacity. They are huge. The 8300 has a capacity of 1.1 terabytes to 1,024 terabytes. That's a petabyte, or another way of saying it is a million gigabytes. The 8300 has lots of capabilities of its own, including flash copy, several mirroring options, and we'll talk about those things. It uses disk drives, serial ATA drives, and those are the same kind of drives that you would find on a PC like a desktop or laptop. It also supports solid-state drives, and we'll talk about that. It has a lot of performance capabilities or attributes that make it a good performer, including high-performance FICON, hyper-PAV, and other things we'll talk about. And toward the end of the presentation, Frank Riccio will talk about extended address volumes and the capacity or the use of large capacity volumes. So let's first look at a high-level overview of a modern storage system as shown on page 4. The first thing that's rather obvious about these systems is they do address mapping. That is, the addresses of the disk that are used by the host are 3390-style addresses. That is, an address is a byte of cylinder and a byte of head, or which track on the cylinder. Those are not the geometry of the disk that are used on these storage subsystems. Instead, those addresses are mapped to the physical disk that exists on the storage subsystem. These storage subsystems also have a large amount of cache. The cache holds, we hope, frequently referenced data. The idea of the cache is so we can avoid having to read data off disk. We keep frequently referenced data, or data that we will reference in the future, in the cache. And then they also have non-volatile storage. That's where they hold updates which have not yet been written to disk, and we'll explain why in a few pages. Next, page 5. Modern storage subsystems use RAID architecture. RAID, or R-A-I-D, stands for Redundant Array of Independent Disk, sometimes called Redundant Array of Inexpensive Disk. The idea of RAID architecture is to write the data such that if we lose one of those disks in the storage system, we still have all the data because the data is written multiple times. There are various schemes for writing it multiple times. It may not be that just each track is written in two places. There are other schemes for doing that, but what it boils down to is that if we lose one of those physical disks, we still have all the data. The good news then is that we very rarely lose an individual volume or a volume as we see it from the host. For IMS, that means we rarely do full database recovery. many, many years ago, we used to have things called head crashes where we would actually physically lose a disk volume, then we would have to recover the database. Today, when we do recoveries in IMS, they are typically timestamp recoveries. We're recovering not from a failure of the disk, but from an application or operational error. Almost the only time that full database recoveries are done in IMS these days are for disaster recovery, where we really have lost the whole system, or we've lost the whole computer room, you might say, or all the processing available at one site because of some hurricane, fire, disaster, or whatever, and we've moved to another site. Of course, the bad news is if we do lose data at the local site, we have probably lost the whole system. And that means instead of just recovering a data set or a few data sets or all those data sets on a volume, we are recovering, well, possibly a terabyte or even a petabyte of data, a much more different problem. As page 6 says, all with RAID architecture, all addresses are virtual. The address known to the ZOS system is a 3390 type of address where we have a byte of cylinder and a byte of head. But that's not the real location of the data. The data is mapped to some other address on the physical disk, and the subsystem dynamically maps addresses to physical drives. That means that data placement is not really physical placement. That is, if I have two data sets on the same volume as far as ZOS is concerned, it doesn't mean that those data sets are on the same volume on the storage subsystem. And that means that the placement of data is not as critical as it once was, because to move from one data set to another does not imply that we will be moving an arm to get to that data. The data may be anywhere on some other disk. So data placement has a different implication with modern storage subsystems. Let's move on to page 7, where we look at the mirroring capabilities of storage subsystems. Mirroring is copying data from one storage system to another, typically done for disaster recovery. There are two kinds of mirroring, synchronous and asynchronous. When we write the data to a disk in our local subsystem, it will then send a signal to a remote subsystem. Well, it doesn't have to be remote, but typically is remote for disaster recovery. And then the data is written to the other system. With synchronous mirroring, the writes to the remote system must complete before we notify the host of the write completion. That means the writes take longer because of the time to transmit the updates to the remote system and the time for the remote system to reply back that the write is complete. So synchronous mirroring elongates writes. Asynchronous mirroring does not elongate writes, because as soon as we write it to the local system, we send a signal to the remote system, but we don't wait for it to write before we reply back to the host saying that the write is complete. So writes are not elongated with asynchronous mirroring, so asynchronous mirroring is better for performance. But of course, if we happen to have a failure, we could have a potential exposure here. We could tell the host we have the data, then we lose our local subsystem, but the remote subsystem never got the data for the update. So we have committed the update, but we don't have the data anymore. So that's the downside of asynchronous mirroring. That exposure tends to be very small, because the updates are done quickly, and we know which updates we have at the remote system, so we typically lose just a very small amount of data. The next page 8, discusses caching. As I mentioned, these storage subsystems have caches in them. The 8300 has up to 256 gigabytes, or a quarter of a terabyte for the cache. The idea of the cache is to keep frequently accessed tracks in the cache so we don't have to physically read them from the disk, which elongates the read time. You might think of cache in the storage system as analogous to a buffer pool with IMS. In IMS, we have a buffer pool, a full function database buffer pool. We read data in it, and we like to keep the data there so we don't have to go out to the storage subsystem to get the data. Similar thing works with caching. We like to keep the data in the cache so we don't have to go all the way out to disk to read it, because it takes longer to read it out of the disk. The cache is also has a capability of doing anticipatory caching, that is, reading data before we ask for it, typically done with sequential processing. If we are reading a track and we're reading a track one after another and it's all sequential processing, the storage subsystem will recognize this and read the tracks into the cache before we ask for them, giving us much faster response times. The caching algorithms used in these modern systems are very sophisticated. It's not just a simple least recently used algorithm. They may stage a block or a part of a track or a full track or a cylinder, or, you know, with anticipatory caching, an entire cylinder before we actually ask for it. And it monitors its own success and adaptively adjusts its caching, trying to do the best job it can of anticipating what the host is going to ask for and having that data already available in the cache. The idea of these algorithms is to make the best use of the cache to and have the lowest probability of actually having to go read the data from the disk at the time of the I/O request. So, as page 9 says, caching is used to avoid disk reads. The data is kept in the cache to satisfy reads from ZOS. We also have non-volatile storage, and non-volatile storage is used to shorten write times. Because when we do a write to one of these systems, we do need to write it to the disk eventually. But if we put the data in non-volatile storage, we can return to the host system with the end of write signal, telling the host that we have the data so it can continue with a write complete condition. So we write the data in non-volatile storage. Non-volatile means if we lose power, we don't lose that data, unlike the normal cache storage, where if we lose power to the cache, then we've lost the data. So we write it to non-volatile storage and then asynchronously write it to disk. Caching reduces disconnect times. Now, I'm going to talk about the various elements of I/O times, but one of those elements is disconnect time. So disconnect time is when an I/O operation has been started, but we're not actually transferring data. So caching gets rid of that disconnect time, because if we have to go to the physical disk, then there's some time we're not transferring data because we're waiting for the arm on the disk to get to the right track, and we're waiting for the track to rotate to get to the block we want. Page 10 talks about solid-state devices. This is a relatively new capability in storage subsystems. The DS8300 now supports solid-state devices. These are an alternative to disk. So an 8300 can have a mix of disk and solid-state devices. Solid-state uses flash technology. You're probably familiar with flash technology because that's typically used in small appliances like your camera probably has a flash disk in it, or may well have a flash disk in it that holds lots of pictures on it. So it is much faster than disk because obviously there are no seeks and no rotational delays because the data is immediately available. The downside of solid-state devices is that they are considerably more expensive than disk for the same amount of storage. So that's the reason we have a mix of disk and solid-state devices. Solid-state devices holding more critical data as far as performance is concerned, but the great volumes of data are typically on disk because of its lower cost. So we want to use the solid-state devices wisely, put the correct data sets on the solid-state devices, correct meaning those that would get the most benefit from being there. So DFSMS is aware of solid-state devices, and these devices may be assigned to storage pools and may be used by data classes, so we can assign the most valuable data sets to the solid-state devices. In order to understand which data sets would benefit most from solid-state devices, there is reporting with SMF in the 42.6 records that includes data set read-only disconnect time. Now, I said disconnect time is the time we've started an operation, but we're not transferring data. One of those things is read, or we're waiting for today for a disk to position itself in the right place, or the arm on the disk to position itself in the right place so we can actually start transferring data. There are other kinds of disconnect times, such as asynchronous mirroring, synchronous mirroring, when we are waiting for the write to the remote device to occur. The I/O operation is going on, but we're not transferring data while we're waiting for the synchronous mirroring to occur. So SMF can now distinguish between different types of disconnect time, and the ones, the data sets that have a large amount of read-only disconnect time are those that might benefit a great deal by moving their data to solid-state devices. So let's look at some other characteristics or capabilities of of these storage systems that can impact our performance. Let me begin on page 11 with parallel access volumes. The idea of parallel access volumes is to provide multiple UCBs or unit control blocks per volume in a ZOS system. Without PAV, if multiple applications want to access or do I/O to the same volume, they cannot do it concurrently. In my example here on the left on page 11, application A is doing I/O, so application B and C have to wait to do I/O to that volume. On the right, with parallel access volumes, we build multiple UCBs in the same LPAR, and since we have multiple UCBs, the ZOS operating system can support multiple concurrent IOs to the same volume. As page 12 points out, PAV is multiple UCBs for the same volume. PAVs allow simultaneous IOs, but there are some restrictions. Reads are simultaneous. Writes to different domains are simultaneous, but writes to the same domain have to be serialized. That kind of begs the question, what's a domain? I'll talk about that in a few more slides when I finish talking about PAV and multiple allegiance. With PAV, there are various kinds of PAV. We first got static PAVs. That was a fixed number of UCBs per volume. So in a ZOS system could have, like, a particular volume might have two or three UCBs. Other volumes maybe one, and you would have to figure out how many you wanted for each volume. Then we got dynamic PAVs, which adjusted dynamically the number of UCBs per volume. It required workload manager goal mode and coordination across the sysflex. That has been replaced by hyper PAV with a DS8000, including the DS8300. It does not use workload manager and does not require coordination across the sysflex, but it does give us multiple UCBs per volume, and they are dynamically adjusted as according to our needs. PAV sharply reduces IOS queue time. IOS queue time is that part of response time that's waiting for the IO to begin in the operating system. That is, ZOS is queued the IO operation waiting for a UCB. Since we have multiple UCBs, we should have less IOS queue time when we use PAV. A similar kind of function is multiple allegiance, as shown on page 13. Multiple allegiance allows concurrent IOs from different LPARs. PAV was multiple IOs concurrently from the same LPAR. With multiple allegiance, we can have multiple IOs from different LPARs. Without multiple allegiance, the storage system would only support one IO to a volume at a time. With multiple allegiance, it allows multiple IOs to the same volume concurrently. As page 14 says, Once again, compatible IOs, that is no extent conflict, from different LPARs may run in parallel. Incompatible IOs are queued in the storage subsystem. Multiple allegiance reduces pin time. Pin time is that part of IO time when the host is okay, we're not queued in the host, but we are waiting because of device busy in the storage system. Now, I mentioned these extent conflicts, so let me explain what I mean by that here on page 15. Reads are not restricted. That is, multiple reads can occur to the same volume at the same time with PAV or multiple allegiance. But writes, there are some restrictions on concurrent writes and writes with reads. A write cannot occur concurrently with another read, with another write or a read to the same domain. That begs the question, what's a domain? A domain is set by the defined extent in the channel program. That kind of begs the question, how is that set? Well, typically for IMS, a domain is an allocation extent for a data set. What I mean by that is if you allocate, let's say, a data set with in cylinders with primary 10 and secondary 2, then we would get 10 cylinders in our first extent, and when we needed more space, we would get two more cylinders. So data in those different extents would be in different domains, and writes could occur to those different domains concurrently. But two writes to that first domain, those first 10 cylinders, would be serialized, either with PAV or with multiple allegiance. So I've mentioned all these elements of IO time, and I kind of summarize them here on page 16. If you talk to a storage administrator, or you happen to look at RMF DASDE reports, as your storage administrator probably does, you'll see that those reports analyze IO response times or report it as IOSQ time, pin time, disconnect time, and connect time. So IOSQ time is the time we're busy in ZOS waiting for a UCB. Pin time, and that's addressed by PAV. Pin time is the time that the device is reserved by another system, so we're waiting in the storage subsystem. That's addressed by multiple allegiance. Disconnect time is the time we've started the IO operation, but we're not actually transferring data. So that's like a read cache miss. That is, the data, is we're doing a read, it's not in the cache, so we got to wait to read it off disk. Or maybe it's a synchronous remote copy. We did a write, we're waiting for the copy of that data to go to a remote device. Or disconnect time is also when we have one of those extent conflicts. We've started the IO, we've gone to the storage subsystem, it's trying to do it, but it recognizes an extent conflict. That's reported as disconnect time. Connect time is, that's the good time. That's the time we're actually transferring data. And so what we are trying to do is eliminate IOSQ time, pin time, and disconnect time as far as possible, and shorten the connect time, move the data as quickly as possible. So our IOS response time is composed of all those things. Page 17 shows some what I call typical IO times. These are not scientific observations, as I point out on this chart. They are just what I would call anecdotal evidence. Here's what people tell me, or I've seen reports of what kind of IO times people can get. The first column says 3390, so we can see that typical I.O. times for a sequential I.O., where we don't have to move the head, do any seeks, then 4K, maybe a little less than 2 milliseconds, 8K, 3 to 4 milliseconds. But if it's random, where we have to have an arm moving, it may be up to around 20 milliseconds. If we have that's on a real 3390. But if we move to one of these modern storage subsystems like the DS8300, and we get a cache hit, as we typically would with sequential processing, then the I.O. times are much faster, like 35 to 60 thousandths of a millisecond. That is 35 to 60 microseconds. That's 30 times faster than the 3390. That's the reason I.O. times are so much faster than they used to be. If we have a cache miss, then our I.O. time, we still have to wait for the arm movement and this and the spinning of the disk, so we're getting off a real disk, and then that might be 5 or 10 milliseconds, so the maybe 2, 3, 4 times faster, but not near as much improvement as we do with cache, as we have with cache. With solid-state devices in the last column, times when we have a cache hit, it doesn't really matter because we're not getting it off the solid-state device or the disk in that case. We're getting exactly the same I.O. times. But if we do have to read it from solid-state devices, our I.O. time is going to be much faster, like less than a millisecond. Instead of 5 or 10 with the 8300 disk, it's going to be less than a millisecond. So caching improves dramatically the I.O. times, and solid-state devices can improve the random reads. Now, that's kind of a background of these modern storage systems. Let me move on to interactions with IMS. As I mentioned before, caching is somewhat analogous to IMS buffer pools. And on page 18, I make the point that IMS full-function buffer pools, we keep frequently referenced data in the pools, so we don't have to do the reads. Well, caching is going to keep frequently read data in the cache. It may prefetch some blocks for sequential processing, just as we may pre-read some data with OSAM sequential buffering. What that means is, with full-function databases with big buffer pools, we may not get a lot of cache hits, because if it's frequently referenced data, we don't even have to go to the storage system to get it. We can get it out of the buffer pool. And storage systems people who look at uses of storage systems may see that your IMS is not a very good user of the cache. IMS looks like a very random reader of data, a random accessing data, when in fact IMS may be using a lot of data at the same location but doesn't have to go to the storage system to get it because it's got it buffered up. So that's with full function, with our look-aside buffering and full function buffer pools. Page 19 shows a phenomenon that can occur with data sharing. With data sharing, we've got two IMS systems accessing the same data. And if IMS 1 updates the data, then the buffer in IMS 2 is going to be invalidated, so IMS 2 cannot use the data that's already in the buffer pool, even though it wants that same block. And that's good because the IMS 1 has updated it. So IMS 1 will write it out to the storage system. If IMS 2 needs the data, it is likely to find it in cache. So heavily used data with data sharing will benefit greatly from the cache in your storage subsystem. And in fact, you may be aware with IMS full function data sharing, we have the capability to keep data in the coupling facility. That is, we can cache data in the coupling facility, but most users don't use that function. I suspect they don't use that function because the caching in the storage system gives them such good response times, like those 35 to 60 or 70 to 100 microsecond response times, that's adequate for data sharing. Let me move on now to page 20, which discusses FastPath buffer pools. FastPath, without virtual storage option, does not have look-aside. That is, data is not kept in the pool for successive transactions. Each region has its own buffers, you know, its NVA or NVA and OVA buffers. So when it needs data, it doesn't benefit from the fact the data has already been read in from another transaction. So FastPath without VSO will benefit greatly from having the data in the cache in the storage system. On the other hand, if we use the virtual storage option with FastPath, then we're going to keep the data, frequently used data at least, in the VSO pool. And typically all the data for an area that's VSO will be in the pool. So we may not get many cache hits for reads because FastPath will get the data out of the VSO pool in the host as opposed to going out the storage system. So those are some of the interactions of IMS dealing with performance and how IMS buffering affects the use of caching in the storage systems. Let me move on to another topic, and that has to do with sizes and the use of the volumes on the storage subsystems. As I page 21 makes the point that storage systems use 3390 emulation. I mentioned that before when I talked about the mapping of the addresses in the storage subsystem. The storage subsystem looks like a bunch of 3390 volumes to the host. The track size of a 3390 is supposedly 56,664 bytes per track. But the actual capacity on a 3390 or an emulated 3390 depends upon block size because of inter-record gaps. The cylinders per volume can be anything on a 3390. They can be what they actually were with real 3390s like model 1, 2, 3, and 9, but we emulate 3390 volumes of various numbers of cylinders per volume. We can call them custom volumes. So the storage administrator can set up your storage so that it can be various sizes, whatever size best fits your needs. And in fact, this can be used to put more data on a volume by creating large volumes and avoiding multi-volume data sets. But your access method may limit the usefulness of large volumes for a single data set. And I'm going to say more about that on the following slides. If you want to have more than 65,520 cylinders on a volume, then you'll need extended address volume support. And Frank's going to talk about that near the end of our presentation. Page 22 shows some disk volume capacities. There's a couple of charts there. The top chart shows the various capacities of the capacities of the various 3390 models, and there's a little asterisk where it says bytes per volume and bytes per track. What that says is the bytes per volume and bytes per track are what I call potential capacities. That is, a track could hold 56,664 bytes, but it's unlikely to hold that much data because we are probably going to have blocks of 4K, 8K, 12K, 16K, or whatever size our blocks are, and we can't get that many bytes. We can't get 56,000 bytes on a track with those block sizes. Typically, and specifically with 4K, 8K kinds of blocks, we can only get 48K per track. So a 3390, which is listed in the top chart of having a capacity of 8,514,000,000 bytes, or 8.5 gig, you might say, only has a capacity of about 6.88 gigabytes. Actually, that depends on what you mean by a gigabyte. And here's a warning, that block in the middle. We as software people in the IMS world tend to think of a gigabyte as 2 to the 30th power, or 1,073,000,000, etc. number of bytes. People in the storage world tend to talk about gigabytes as 1 billion bytes, 1 followed by 9 zeros. That leads to some misunderstandings because two problems here. A storage person will tell you that the 3390 Model 9 has 8.5 gigabytes of capacity. But 8.5 gigabytes is not 8 gigabytes if a gigabyte, I mean, that number is not 8 gigabytes if you think a gigabyte is 2 to the 30th. It's 2 to the, that number of 8,514,000,000, et cetera, is slightly less than 8 gigabytes if a gigabyte is 2 to the 30th power. That's compounded by the problem that we can't really get 56,664 bytes on a track. So when we talk to our storage people, we need to understand that if they give us a 3390 Model 9, we can probably get a little less than 7 gig on it. They think we're going to get 8.5 gig because we're talking different language. But there are other problems with using these volumes or potential misunderstandings. And let me move on to page 23 and talk about large sequential data sets. Before ZOS 1.7, a sequential data set was limited to 65,536 tracks per volume. So you can only get about 3 gigabytes on a volume, even though the volume might have any number of cylinders larger than that, or many, many more tracks than that. But the access methods limited us to 65,536 tracks per volume for a data set. That restriction was lifted in ZOS 1.7, but with the implementation of large sequential data sets, which you get by specifying DS type equal large. IMS version 10 takes advantage of that so that OSAM data sets, including database data sets, logs, trace data sets, message queues, and BSAM, GSAM, BSAM files, and image copy and change accum output data sets may use this capability and have data sets that are bigger than 3 gigabytes on one volume. That's a big advantage when we try to avoid multi-volume OSAM data sets particularly. The next two pages are 24 and 25, and I'm going to skip over those in this presentation. I just wanted to include them in the materials because they give you some information about allocating VSAM and OSAM data sets and how many extents they can be and how many volumes they can occupy. Occasionally we get questions on that, so I just included that, but I'm not going to talk about it. Could be kind of boring topic to talk about. Instead, I'm going to move on to page 26 and talk a little bit about flash copy. Flash copy is a wonderful capability of these storage subsystems. It is the capability to copy a volume or a data set and in a very, very quick manner. The copy is created in the same storage system. It's almost instantaneous. The way the copy is done is by creating another map of the actual data on the disk. So let's say we're going to flash copy a data set. Well, we have a map of where that data set resides on where we think it resides on 3390s as a ZOS view of the data, and where the storage system subsystem has a map of where it actually resides on its physical disk, or I guess on its solid state devices. When we say copy it, all the storage system has to do to copy the data set is copy the map. And when it's copied the map, it has two maps pointing to the same place, so it has another copy of the data. Of course, if anybody updates any of that data, then it would have to write the updated data to another location and change one of the maps of one of the two data sets, depending on which one was changed. So flash copy is a very quick copy. Version 10 of IMS added the capability to exploit flash copy in the Image Copy 2 utility. This capability requires ZOS 1.8, and also the database recovery utility was enhanced to use these image copies as input. The IBM High Performance Image Copy tool also supports flash copy. It does not require ZOS 1.8. But it does have the restriction of fuzzy copies of KSDSs are not allowed. Bob will tell you more about high-performance image copies, exploitation of flash copy in a couple of minutes. But first I wanted to compare flash copy with concurrent copy as shown on page 27 and 28. Concurrent copy was available already in IMS. Ever since version 6 of IMS, the Image Copy 2 utility could invoke concurrent copy. But first let me talk about flash copy, how it works. I said it just copies the map. So the flash copy on page 27, I point out that copy is to the same subsystem. It's a single phase copy. It creates an exact copy of the data set, and we can use it with Image Copy 2 in version 10 or with high performance image copy. What the illustration on 27 is supposed to show is that the host system, the ZOS, does almost nothing. It sends a signal to the storage system saying, copy this data set. The storage system does all the work, although it really doesn't have much work to do. I'm going to contrast that with concurrent copy on page 28. Concurrent copy was what Image Copy 2's other option is, and what Image Copy 2 has used since version 6. With concurrent copy, the data is actually sent from the storage system to the host, and the host writes it out, either to the same storage system or to another storage system or disk or to tape, so we have more capability. We can write it anywhere. But it's a two-phase copy. The logical copy and physical copy are the two phases. Logical copy is very quick because it's one of those, it kind of copies the mapping, but then we have to do the physical copy to write the copy, to send it to the host, and the host has to write it out. And the copy format may be different. It could be an exact copy, but that's not what Image Copy 2 does. High Performance Image Copy has that option, but Image Copy 2 uses a dump format. So when we read the data, we have to reformat it before we can use the data. Obviously, concurrent copy is used by Image Copy 2 from all versions of IMS and by High Performance Image Copy. With that, I'm going to pass this over to Bob Maggott, who's going to tell us more about High Performance Image Copy, use of flash copy. Bob?
Thank you, Rich. I just wanted to take this opportunity to point out a couple of the highlights that we've added to our High Performance Image Copy tool to support flash copy technology. Like Rich mentioned, the Image Copy 2 utility that comes with IMS is only capable of performing a flash copy at version 10 and later. High Performance Image Copy support dates back to IMS version 9 or later. And the way that we've implemented that, since there is no support in DBRC for flash copy with IMS version 9, we actually mark these image copies, the flash copy image copies, as SMS non-concurrent image copy or SMS concurrent image copy, which IMS had used in the past for snapshot copy. These databases can then be recovered, and automatically these image copies will automatically be recognized by our High Performance Image Copy recovery function or our database recovery facility, recovery facility. The High Performance Image Copy was also updated to provide an additional level of automation for what we call crisp image copies, or also known as batch image copies. Our TOI, our tools online interface, has the capability to interface with the IMS online system and automatically initiate a database recovery or database dump command before the image copy is taken. And immediately after the logical copy is complete, the database is reallocated to IMS for access to the IMS system. So the outage is very, very quick because flash copy itself is very, very quick. And the database can be accessed almost immediately after the flash copy is complete. And you can see how that whole process works in that little figure down below. On the next slide, slide 30, our flash copy support also allows you to take dual image copies. A secondary image copy can be either a flash copy or a batch format image copy, which can then be written to tape. And the advantage here being that you can end up with you can get another flash copy out of it, but also, more importantly, you could end up with a batch image copy. And you can go back, if you don't want to absorb as much space for the flash copy, you can scratch that flash copy and still end up with the batch image copy, which you can then recover with subsequently. The idea being that the flash copy is taken very, very quickly, and out of that you can get the batch format image copy. However, if you want to recover from the recover that database from the secondary image copy, you'll need to go back and manually change that image copy type back to either batch or concurrent image copy. So you can see in this diagram how the flash copy is taken. After the flash copy is taken, and the database is restarted, we can generate the secondary tape image copy. So that's pretty much what I have, and I'll now turn it back to Frank to explain EAV. Frank?
Thank you, Bob. We're on page 31 now, and we're going to talk a little bit about EAV volumes, the architecture of some of the EAV volumes, and then how does IMS take advantage, and what did it have to do to support EAV volumes? So the EAV volumes are large volumes. They are addressing the critical problem that customers have right now, that data on the ZOS platform is growing, and there's a lot of data that we need to store. So what the solution to this problem is that we're going to continue with the direction that was started with the 3390 models. We're going to define larger volumes by increasing the number of cylinders per volume. So today, you can define a volume when you have cylinders up to the maximum of basically 64K. So on the next page, page 32, we see some progression of the capacity of some of the volumes. Starting back to the early versions of the 3390, as you can see, the growth of these volumes in terms of the capacity is really tremendous. You can see from all the way from 3 gigabytes. Now we're talking that an EAV volume can hold into the terabytes of data. So it's a significant growth in volume capacity. And with ZOS version 10, IMS will support data on these EAV volumes. Now to talk about a little bit more about what are they and what is the architecture of these, we'll look at page 33 and talk a little bit about the architecture of the EAV volumes. So EAV volumes has more than 64K cylinders. So the EAV volume is broken up into two sections. The sections that address cylinders that are less than 64K are called the track managed space. The section on the EAV volumes that has cylinders greater than 64K, that's the cylinder managed space. Okay. The units of allocation that's interesting on these is that when we allocate storage on the track managed space, we're used to allocating storage in tracks and cylinders. When we get to the cylinder managed space, now we're allocating units in a different unit. It's called a multi-cylinder unit, and that's 21 cylinders is the basic unit of allocation for data in the cylinder managed space. So if we look at the traditional way of accessing this data on here, we have track formats, the cylinder formats that we're used to, CCHH. So now how do we deal with accessing data when cylinders are greater than 64K? So for EAVs, we have a new track address format. So on page 34, we look at the existing track format. So this is a CCHH that we've been familiar with for many years. The high order, it's a 32-bit number. The high order is the cylinder, and then followed by the head or the track. So this, since it's a half-word cylinder, we get 64K, and a half-word for the track number, that's up to 64K. Well, we have 1 to 15 tracks. So we really don't need that low, the 16 bits for the track number. So what was done to be able to handle cylinders greater than 65K, they took the high order 3Hs and stole them, and now they've made them part of the cylinder. Because the things that is consistent with the hardware, the architecture of all these volumes is that the number of tracks per cylinder, block sizes, all that remains the same, regardless of what volume, what version of the 3390 volumes you're using. That geometry hasn't changed. So if we look at page 35, we'll see the new format of the track address. So it's no longer 4-byte the CCHH that we're familiar with. We don't have a 16-bit cylinder number anymore. We have a 28 cylinder numbers. And as I mentioned, we took three of those H's and converted them, and now they're part of the cylinders. Okay, so the H is still a 4-bit track number because we have 15 tracks per cylinder. So we only need the 4 bits. We didn't need all the other high order bits. So the three nibbles that we took become the 12 bits, the high order 12 bits of the 28-bit cylinder number, and the original CCs is the low order 16 bits of the 28 cylinder number. So in the first 2 bytes, we still have a 64K number, which can represent for data in the track managed space. It's still compatible with what we were used to before. When you get into the cylinder managed space, now we make use of the next three nibbles. Okay, so we now have the 20. That's how we format the 28-bit cylinder number. Now, as far as the what has to change? So if anybody is using CCHH in their programs, obviously because the cylinder number is changing from 16-bit to 28-bit, those programs have to change. So in the ZOS manuals, there's a lot of description about what needs to change if you're making use of the track address. On the next page, I talk about what did IMS have to do to be able to support the DS-8000 EAV volumes. Well, the good news is we didn't have to do a whole lot. In ZOS 110, support for data in the EAV volumes is for VSAM data sets. IMS use of VSAM data sets is very straightforward. We make use of standard VSAM access method services. We use gets, we use puts. We don't look at CCHH for VSAM data sets. Okay? So IMS will support in ZOS 110 and IMS version 10 and version 9 data sets, VSAM data sets on an EAV volume, on the cylinder portion of the EAV volume. And that includes the DEDBs, full function databases, VSAM, as well as the recons. Now, some of the changes that we made in IMS are, as I say, cosmetic. We have some places where if we have a log rec, if we have a IO error, we log the CCHH of the error. The 26 log record, the 24 log record, is enhanced to include the indication that this particular volume that had the error was an EAV volume, and we just format the cylinder in the normalized format. So the changes are basically cosmetic and nothing significant. It doesn't change the size of IMS databases. They stay exactly the same, 4 gigabytes and 8 gigabytes. The support for this is available in IMS version 10, IMS version 9, and then the list on page 36, we have a couple of the APARs, the PTFs, that provide that support. On the next page, there's a couple of the PTF numbers also for the IMS tools support for the EAV volumes. Tools, again, had to make some changes to support the new track addresses, but again, those are cosmetic also. And that's all I have on EAV volumes, and I'll turn it back to Rich that we can summarize this presentation.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Frank. One point, I think on page 36 we had a typo. VSAM is 4 gigabyte limit. Frank said 4 gigabytes. I'm not sure we corrected that on the slides you got. It's 4 gigabytes for VSAM and 8 gigabytes for OSAM non-HALDB. Let me just summarize what we've said. I think it's pretty obvious what we've talked about is modern storage subsystems and how they are configured, their use of virtualization, and what that means as far as availability and performance available to users of them, including IMS. Also, these systems provide their own functions, such as mirroring and flash copy, of which we can take advantage, and we try to point out the IMS interfaces and uses of and what that means for IMS users as far as the capabilities of caching and IMS's own pools and our data set allocations and the use of the new capabilities such as EAV. And with that, I would now like to turn it back to the operator.
Thank you, speakers. Now we would like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Right after the survey, we will have a live question and answer session with the presenters. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection. Question 1. Please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. If it was low, press star 3. You may vote now. Once again, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. If it was low, press star 3. Please vote now. Question two, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference, if it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. You may vote now. Again, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference, if it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. And if it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. Please vote now. Question 3. What version of IMS are you currently on? If version 10, press star 1. If version 9, press star 2. If version 8, press star 3. If version 7 and below, press star 4. You may vote now. Again, what version of IMS are you currently on? If version 10, press star 1. If version 9, press star 2. If version 8, press star 3. And if version 7 and below, press star 4. Please vote now. Question 4. For those not on IMS 10, what is your planned use of IMS 10? If you plan to install IMS 10 within the next 6 to 12 months, press star 1. If you are interested in moving to IMS 10 within the next 2 years, press star 2. If you are not interested in IMS 10 at this time, press star 3. You may vote now. Again, for those not on IMS 10, what is your planned use of IMS 10? If you plan to install IMS 10 in the next 6 to 12 months, press star 1. If you are interested in moving to IMS 10 within the next 2 years, press star 2. If you are not interested in IMS 10 at this time, press star 3. Please vote now. And question 5. We hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you are interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. You may vote now. Again, we hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you are interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. Please vote now. That concludes our survey. Thank you all for your participation. Now let's move to your questions. To ask a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone at any time. One moment, please, for any questions. Ralph Neuber, you may ask your question.
Hi. Good morning, afternoon. I have several questions. Do we have enough time for several questions?
We'll see. Start asking.
Okay. How you doing, Rich?
Good.
All right. My first question is, I like the presentation. It was very good. It's the kind of thing that we've been looking for a while. The first one's around EAV. What should we be aware of, or what are your thoughts on UCB contention now that we're increasing the size like we are?
I haven't seen any numbers on that, but from what I understand from the hardware folks, that doesn't seem to present a problem, but Rich, do you have any more information than that?
No, I mean, I think it might, you know, it might be a case where, you know, reasonable thoughts about where you allocate data might, you know, apply. I mean, you know, even though you can create these huge volumes, you might not want to put all your data on one volume. The idea of this is that we were running out of the capability to have more volumes. And so, I mean, we were running out of the capability to have more data because we were running out of volumes. So the assumption is you're going to kind of max out the number of volumes or have a very large number of volumes, which would tend, I mean, before you'd use all these EAV volumes, that would tend to make all your I/O spread across many volumes and causing UCB contention not to be such a problem, especially with also with PAV and MA having their roles.
Okay. I guess that's something we'll grow with. I think they have, what, four address UCBs now, I think, or more. So I know we were running out of addresses.
Right.
Okay. It seems like we're still stuck with 4 gigabyte OSAM and vSAM. Is there any thoughts about extended, like DB2 has with extended vSAM, to get away from that 4 gigabyte limit so we don't have to repartition a lot?
No, I mean, the direction both for DEDBs and HALDBs is to go partition and not to increase the size of the of each individual partition.
Okay, so we can't get around that technical limitation of 4 gigabytes per partition, right?
That's right, that's right.
And that'll be, I guess, forever and ever, I suppose.
In our lifetime.
until we change the geometry, I guess. I mean,
yep.
Possibly, that's probably not going to happen either, right?
It looks like the direction that the hardware is going is that for these disks, the geometry is going to be consistent.
Yeah, I've been around since the different changes of 3330 and 3350 and then 80 and then 90, and then we're stuck with this. So I understand. Looping back to EAV, how would our definitions look? How do we set this up? The storage folks have to be involved somewhat, I would imagine. You mentioned 21-cylinder. How would a definition look for maybe an 8CAMS allocate or vSAM def that would take advantage of EAV?
Well, you can still allocate. You still can use your existing JCL to do the allocations. It's just that it's going to round up. So if you try to put a lot of volume data set on the cylinder managed space and you allocate one cylinder, well, you're going to wind up with 21 cylinders because the unit of allocation is 21. So you have to be careful about, you don't want to put a two-cylinder data set on the cylinder managed space. I mean, that's for, you're going to put your big data sets up in there.
Okay, so I'm trying to play this out. In my mind, we would work with the storage folks to create a storage pool using EAV?
Pretty much, yep.
Okay, and then from there, management would kick in and manage it properly.
Yeah.
The next thing, hardware requirements for flash copy, now and ongoing. I know in the past we looked at this, but some of our storage subsystems didn't have the right microcode. Is the DASDI subsystems out there, no matter what vendor, pretty much up to speed with flash copy and requirements now going forward?
I don't know. I really don't know for other vendors. I think the DS8300 just, if you get one today, they have the flash copy capability. I think that's standard, but I'm actually not sure about that either. And I certainly can't speak for what's standard on other vendors. And other vendors may have other similar solutions. Oftentimes, they implement similar kinds of functionality, but they implement it differently. And whether it's compatible with our software or not depends.
Okay.
Oftentimes, they have their own utility to do some of their functions.
Is there a particular we have multiple vendors in the game, so we always have to be aware of that.
Right.
I guess it goes for hardware compression too, doesn't it? Along the same lines.
Yeah.
As far as current storage subsystems. Next question. Are third-party vendors on board with the flash copy, do you think, for the most part, with the backup and recovery schemes? Or is that not a valid question for this forum?
Probably not a valid question because I really can't speak for them, and I don't know. So I don't know if they all are or not.
Okay, but it's something that's open source, I guess, or whatever. It could be shared for requirements, right? Okay. Next question is, I already threw that out, new geometry won't happen. Last question I got. This is good that the EAVs give you the opportunity to put the big stuff out there and probably put it all in one extent. Can you give us your thoughts and views on extent processing these days, OSIM, VSIM? I've seen some things out on NIMAS lists that it's really not an issue, but I figured I'd ask anyway.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Ralph.
Well, you know, in the old days, you know, we didn't want to get into a lot of extents because of chains and pointing and stuff like that. And these days, people are saying extents really don't matter. They're not such a big issue. Same thing along the lines of CI and CA splits, too. Do you have any thoughts on just the whole concept and state of the extent processing scenario? Is many extents bad versus one extent? I mean, is that still a consideration?
I don't think it's as big a consideration as it once was. In fact, occasionally, more extents, I mean, you could build a case, I don't know if it's practical or not, that more extents might be good because of limiting the extent conflicts with PAV or MA. Remember, that was allocation extents, so more extents you might get more concurrent writes if that were really a problem, although I think that's probably not a typical problem. I think CI-CA splits still matter, but I think the extent's probably not as important as it used to be.
Yeah, we've seen some documentation, I think, from Maine Star, does that sound familiar, about
Maine.
Whether splits are good or bad. And there's really, is there a resource somewhere we can read up about the current state of CI and CA splits? Is there an offering somewhere that we could, a guideline that we could look at?
There may be, but I'm not familiar with what it would be. I can't point you anything. Sorry.
That's all right. That's all I have.
Thanks, Ralph. Good question.
Okay.
John Betzel, you may ask your question.
Yes, I have a question about EAV volumes, a reference FOIL 36. You mentioned that the support allows IMS VSAM data sets. What about OSAM?
Okay, in ZOS 110, the support for EAV volumes is to be able to put VSAM data sets in the cylinder-managed space of the EAV volume. So all other data sets will not be able to be supported until future releases of ZOS. So that takes care of OSAM. So for VSAM, we can put those data sets on the cylinder portion. OSAM still need to go below. If you look at the track address that was changed from a 16-bit to 28-bit cylinder number, since we in IMS just use the standard VSAM services, it wasn't much of a change for us other than some cosmetic stuff. OSAM, as you can imagine, is going to be a little bit more complex, okay, because we make big-time use of CCHH. And so we have our own channel programs, and so we're going to have to make some significant changes there. So in future releases of ZOS, when they do come out with the support for non-VSAM data sets on the cylinder-managed portion of the volume, we will have to make some changes to OSAM in order to be able to support that. But as far as ZOS 110 and IMS version 9 and 10, it's only VSAM data sets.
Okay, thank you.
Joe Schweitzer, you may ask your question.
Yes, hello. You mentioned large data sets that IMS 10 supports some for logs and GSAM, change of queue. Does that include the large buffering capability for image copies being extended to logs and change of queues?
I'm not sure what you're saying there, but no, the support is for data sets on one volume bigger than about 3 gigabytes or more than 65,536 tracks per volume for those image copy data sets and change of cum data sets. That's all that support is.
Okay. Yeah, it's not what I had in mind then. Thank you. As far as concurrent copy would go to data spaces if it couldn't keep up with things. Flash copy, if it can't keep up with things, will it go into data spaces on the host? Or?
No, because flash copy doesn't use the host at all for the copy. So it'll keep up. The not keeping up in concurrent copy was the copying of the data to the host and then back out to the output data set. With flash copy, we just flash the map, and we just copy the map. So there is no physical copying of the data at all with flash copy. I mean, the actual data you have, there's still just one copy of it until you modify it. So it's there's no falling behind. And if we and there's two things. There's no falling behind because of the technique used. And the second thing, we don't use the host anyway.
But if you have to keep the old version around, there becomes a question, what if you don't have room on the controller or the disk to hold that? That's where a concurrent copy would punt and send it to the host and put it in data spaces.
But it was keeping copies of the changed data that really didn't belong to it. I mean, it was keeping copy of the old data and the new data for the data set, but the new data set was being written elsewhere. With flash copy, both copies of the data set are in the same storage subsystem. So if it can allocate space for it, it knows it can have it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's
sure.
It.
Ken Wolf, you may ask your question.
Hello. For a long time, the recommendation for recovery control data sets was to place each on its own volume with its own dedicated catalog. Does use of any of these new disk storage system features change that recommendation in any way, or does it have any effect on that?
I'll venture an answer. I don't think any of these things change those considerations, because those considerations were about avoiding some deadlock situations with enqueuing, and none of this affects any of the kind of enqueuing done for data sets.
Right. I think for the recons, what we do is issue a reserve on the volume whenever we have to update. And I don't think that the recommendation is going to go away with any of this new enhancements that have come along. I think that the recommendation to put the recon on its own volume is still there. I think that some of the enhancements to recon that have come along make performance enhancements to the use of the recon data sets and reduce contention, but none of these enhancements, any of these hardware enhancements, really address any of that requirement.
Okay, thank you.
Mike Brauweiler, you may ask your question.
A couple of questions on EAVs. I get the impression from what I've been hearing that it is possible to locate a new data set in the cylinder managed space, even if there's plenty of room in the track managed space. Is that true?
You can still place data sets, yes.
Just out of curiosity, how would you do that?
There's a whole description on that in the ZOS manuals on how to do allocations and all that. But you can still right now I've lost my train of thought. There is. If you look at the ZOS manuals, it'll tell you exactly how to allocate on the, whether you want it on the cylinder or the track managed space portion of the volume. So
okay.
I mean, it's there in the ZOS doc.
That's fair.
I just can't remember right now.
Are there any flash copy considerations for the EAVs that are specific to them?
I don't think so. I think all of the support utilities are can take advantage of EAV volumes. All the access method services, catalog services, utilities, all these programs that print information about DASI, about data sets, about or even TSO, all of those have been enhanced to be able to support the new track, the new cylinder address. So all that support should be there.
Okay, thank you.
Ralph Newber, you may ask your question. Mr. Newber, your line is open. Please check your mute button.
Sorry, thanks. Slide 26, flash copy again. The note there about fuzzy copies, does that mean we would have to DBD or DBR during the flash copy process if we targeted some big 4 gig KSDSs, for example?
Would it, if you're talking about high performance image copy support?
Oh, I'm sorry, it is under high performance.
Yeah, but if it's image copy 2 with version 10, no, you can flash copy. You can take a fuzzy copy while updates are going on, even in KSDS.
Oh, that's good news. I mean, that comes with base IMS, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, is
that deficiency in HPIC, or is that going to be down the road?
I think Rich put that there only for the provision for it being below ZOS 1.8. Otherwise, that high-performance image copy has the same capabilities for copying KSDSs as well.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very good. Thank you.
At this time, I show that we have no further questions. I'd like to turn it back to the presenters for closing comments.
Well, this is Rich again. I don't think we have any closing comments other than thanking all of you for listening and thanking all those who asked questions. Very good questions. We're glad we could clarify those things. So we appreciate your attendance today.
Thank you.